I think that the consumer already knew that commissions were negotiable. So this idea that everybody was charging a 6% fee, in my market, 5% has been the norm since I started. There were negotiable, there were people who paid less, there were people who paid a little bit more, different arrangements where maybe if the listing agent represented both sides, that the fee was reduced. So this idea that negotiating fees is a novel concept has not been the case here.
Good morning. This is Deconstruct, a podcast from The Real Deal. I'm Isabella Farr.
I'm Susanna Cavanaugh. It's Monday, March 25th.
If you follow us on social media, you probably will guess today's topic. We're breaking down the NAR settlement and what it means for agents, brokers, housing prices, and the industry at large.
We talked to residential reporters Sheridan Wall and Harrison Connery, who've been doggedly following this case and the dozens more, and Michael Normand, who runs brokerage Normand & Associates out of Beverly Hills. He will weigh in on his takeaways from the settlement.
And bluntly speaking, that was the news of last week, but we will run you through a handful of our other top stories.
I'm going to start with this piece about what Third Avenue can tell us about the future of New York's office market.
That was from The Real Deal's David Westenhaver.
Mm-hmm. So the news here is Third Avenue is in worse shape than other stretches of the city. The vacancy rate on Third Avenue is 20%. And then if you skip over to Sixth or Park, it's about 12%. In part, that's because the offices are older. They can't claim they're the Class A product that tenants demand right now. They pooled lower rents and also carried higher vacancy rates even before the pandemic.
So what's the play there?
It's kind of a throw everything at the wall and see what sticks approach, I guess, if we're looking at the market at large. So some are renovating, like Durst is at 825 Third. 850 Third, which is owned by HPS Investment Partners, is trying something similar. Chitreat sold that building to avoid foreclosure last March.
And what about conversions?
Yeah, those are happening too. So SL Green is giving it a go at 750 Third. But as we know, conversions are very hard. You've got to get light in there. There are the challenges of floor plates that may be too big. And you need incentives. SL Green says it needs a property tax break. So it's not an easy fix.
That's a good plug for us, though. We're going to cover which cities are incentivizing conversions and how in an upcoming episode. We've also got an episode lined up on construction financing, and we get a little bit into how lenders think about office to residential conversions, too.
All right, let's talk about Patrick Carroll.
I'll take this one. So some of you may remember Carroll, who was a multifamily investor and syndicator. He allegedly spit in a restaurant manager's face last year. And then in October, he was arrested for battery. He assaulted a couple of employees at a strip club in Miami.
I do remember Carroll. So what has he done now? What's the latest?
So he posted a video on Instagram that he then took down of him firing a gun on a boat docked in his backyard.
Long live Her Majesty.
Ready?
Yeah.
Oh, no, be careful, Pat. Shut up.
Then he points the gun at the camera and talks about his Second Amendment rights.
Right. So it's my government right. You know, I did it the right way. I've been trained. I have a carry concealed permit. I'm way offshore. And I know how to handle these guns.
So that prompted a visit from the Miami police.
Okay. I didn't do anything wrong. Look at all the cops, though.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't do anything wrong. You're shooting a gun in the back. We don't know if it's bullets or rounds or anything.
I'm not putting them on my property.
Carroll posted videos on his Instagram showing that altercation.
Am I under arrest? I just need to know because I'm going to ask my lawyer.
Find out what's going on.
There's some text on the video. He calls the cops pigs. He claims to be a charitable guy busting his ass. He's stalking around in a MAGA hat, breathing heavy, flanked by a Doberman.
Wow. Yeah, quite a scene.
So then on Thursday, he's ordered by the police to undergo a mental health evaluation. He did tell The Real Deal that he was firing blanks in the video, but he does have to give up his guns for 3 days as a result of the evaluation order.
And that's obviously a sensitive story. Francisco Alvarado, our South Florida reporter, has really done a great job treating it as such.
And then, Susanna, can you touch on your story on Rialto and Signature?
So a shopping mall owner in Staten Island sued Rialto Capital Advisors, the FDIC, and the venture that owns a stake in Signature Bank CRE loans.
Can you explain that venture again?
So you may remember the FDIC Signature loan sale.
Yes.
How could we forget? A venture that includes two Blackstone entities, Rialto and the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, won a 20% stake in a joint venture that holds Signature's commercial real estate loan book, so not the rent-stabilized stuff. And the FDIC controls the rest.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So the shopping center owner sued, claiming Rialto was engineering defaults, which the owner alleges is possibly illegal. And the claims there are that Rialto would get fees from creating those defaults. To get into the nitty-gritty a bit, the owner said his loan terms with Signature allowed for an extension, and Rialto said the owner would have to sign a pre-negotiation agreement, also pay for attorney's fees, and then ultimately, the joint venture that we just talked about sent him a proposed extension letter saying he would need to declare himself in default.
Okay, and Rialto is typically a special servicer, but is the loan servicer on these loans? Some have said special servicers purposely stretch out extension discussions on CMBS deals because it lets them rake in larger fees and interests.
Right. Rialto declined to comment for the suit. There are rumblings that the Staten Island landlord is not alone in these allegations, but we have yet to see any other complaints filed, so nothing has been confirmed yet.
All right, let's launch into today's meat. What to know about the NAR settlement. So last week, the National Association of Realtors settled a lawsuit brought by a group of home sellers in Missouri. That was known as the Sitzer-Burnett case. We've talked about it on the show a number of times before. NAR agreed to pay about $418 million to settle that case. The settlement also resolves claims against over 1 million NAR members, all state, territorial, and local realtor associations, all association-owned MLSs, and all brokerages run by at least one NAR member that did less than $2 billion in sales volume in 2022. Needless to say, it's a lot of brokerages across the country.
So this is really just kind of a fraction of what they might have had to pay?
That's Sheridan Wohl, one of our residential reporters in New York.
If the judge approves the settlement plan, this will actually probably be much cheaper. Even the cost of appealing this would have likely been as much of the judgment itself.
And it's important to note,
The organization continues to defend its practices and has not admitted any wrongdoing by settling. But with the sum comes several rule changes, a couple of which are pretty significant.
First, NAR agreed to scrap its commission sharing rule, which was at the core of the Sitzer-Burnett case and a number of copycat suits that have cropped up across the country since then. Here's Sheridan on what that means.
So previously, they required listing brokers to offer commissions to buyer's agents on the MLS. Traditionally, that offer could be as low as 1 cent, though they recently changed that to $0, like right before the trial. Now they're like completely banning it. So listing brokers can't make offers of compensation to the buyer's agent at all on the MLS. That just won't be a field that's included anymore.
So when you look at a real estate listing now on Zillow or on the MLS or on Redfin, there's a field that says buyer's agent compensation. That might say 2.5 or 2%. It might say 1%. That field will no longer exist. And one of the sticking points in the trial was this argument that NAR encouraged or forced its agents into a 6% commission.
In a sophisticated market like Los Angeles, where buyers and sellers have been negotiating fees since I started back in 2004.
That's Michael Normand, who runs Normand & Associates in Los Angeles. His brokerage has three offices here and close to 200 agents.
I think that the consumer already knew that commissions were negotiable. So this idea that everybody was charging a 6% fee, in my market, 5% has been the norm since I started. There were negotiable, there were people who paid less, there were people who paid a little bit more, different arrangements where maybe if the listing agent represented both sides, that the fee was reduced. So this idea that negotiating fees is a novel concept has not been the case here.
It's worth emphasizing that scrapping the commission sharing rule does not mean that the 5 or 6% commission will go away or that commissions will shrink overall. And the crux of the lawsuit, as Sheridan puts it, was
commissions have always, you know, they have always been negotiable, but it's whether or not people were necessarily aware of the how much they can negotiate. And, you know, the plaintiff's argument is certainly that there may have been, you know, a bit of an imbalance there.
On to the second rule that's changing.
They're also mandating that buyer's agents get their buyers to sign exclusive agreements before they even take them on a tour of a home. And buyer's agreements, they've existed. You know, people use, there are agents that use them. A lot of the realtor boards have their own, you know, if you go on their website, they'll have, you know, an example buyer's agreement. That stuff exists, but it's never really been required across the board before. So that will change business for a lot of agents.
Here's Michael on those buyer representation and broker compensation agreements.
So I think that change, assuming that the judge approves the settlement, and that sort of goes into effect in mid-July, that will be an NAR requirement. I think that's good. I think that that's a win for the consumer. So they know kind of how the commission works, assuming that they were unaware of how it worked. And I think it's also good for the agents because it formalizes an agreement. But this idea that the buyers thought that we were working for free or that the sellers were unaware that, you know, they were paying a real estate agent and they could offer more or less, I think that that is a little bit of an inaccurate statement, at least in the greater LA area.
Another idea that has been thrown around a little bit is that this will change who pays for buyer's agents. Right now, it's customary that the seller pays for buyer's agents. Buyer's agent compensation comes directly out of the entire purchase price, funded into escrow once the sale closes.
There's certainly a lot of discussion about shifting the burden. So with these buyer's agreements, you know, they're required to spell out what the services are that they provide and how they expect to be compensated. And so, of course, you know, as part of that, it could be that they now expect buyers to actually do the compensation, whether that's through like flat fees. I've heard that talked about a little bit in the broker community. Or if, you know, they negotiate that as part of the deal-making process, if the seller wants, you know, agrees to pay for that, or if buyers pay for it up front. I mean, that's part of the whole ongoing conversation.
But Michael doesn't think that's going to be the case.
Here are sort of the, I would argue, the three reasons why a seller would want to keep the structure the way it's historically been. Okay, so the first reason is affordability, right? When you're buying a house, and let's just say in LA, houses all day long, 3 million plus, 4 million plus. So let's just say you're buying a $4 million house. Okay, that usually means you have to come with a down payment of about $1 million. In addition to the down payment of $1 million, to then have to write a check to your agent for $100,000 does not sound ideal. And lenders have reserve requirements, right? Okay, so you put down $1 million, we loan you $3 million, and we want to see reserves that you have money left over to make your payments, to be able to do it. So the beauty of the traditional or historical system was that it was financed. The seller was paying for it, but it was factored into the price and it was financed for the buyer, right? The second reason would be limiting your buyer pool. I could see a world where there are buyers that say, I don't want my agent to show me things that I have to write a check for. I don't want to pay my agent. And also, you know, as a seller, the way to get the most exposure and the highest dollar amount for your property is to get the largest buyer pool possible. And then the third reasoning is the idea of having two negotiations. There are a lot of moving parts in a real estate deal. It's a complex, infrequent transaction. And now you're negotiating price and you're negotiating commissions. So I think that that's a lot, and that's a lot of things to deal with. And like anything, the simpler you keep a deal, the more likely it is to close.
And the big looming question, will any of this impact home prices? Here's Harrison Connery, another one of our residential reporters in New York.
So it's possible home prices would go down. And, you know, as a result of the rule changes, you know, there's a scenario in which, for example, the price comes down to reflect the fact that the buyer is paying, you know, their agent themselves. So, you know, you take out whatever agreed commission rate, whatever commission rate was agreed upon or whatever flat fee was agreed upon, you take that out of the price of the house. But there's other situations in which, you know, nothing will happen because supply, demand is outstripping supply by so much. We have a really severe undersupply of homes. So that's really what dictates home prices is, you know, is there a relationship between supply and demand? The agents I've spoken to are pretty pessimistic about there being any kind of meaningful impact on home prices.
And this is extreme, but another question is, will buyers start buying homes without an agent altogether?
Yeah, they can definitely represent themselves, or, you know, it's called, you know, going without representation. But it's kind of a bad idea, according to a lot of people. And you know, their arguments for that make sense. You know, it's probably the biggest investment you'll ever make in your life. So why would you want to do that, you know, without someone with some level of expertise kind of representing your interests? Because the seller's agent, you know, doesn't represent your interests.
I do think like the bigger shift will not necessarily be, you know, whether or not people lose buyer's agents. I think good, you know, good buyer's agents are going to figure out a way that they, you know, make their services essential.
Deconstruct airs every Monday on Apple, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Or you can listen at therealdeal.com. For comments on this episode or on the series, or if you have a guest or idea you'd like to pitch, feel free to reach me or Susanna at podcasts@therealdeal.com. Next week, we're airing an audio supplement to our monthly interview, The Closing. Tune in then.